Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 218. Yes, you heard me right. This is podcast number 218. I think last time I said with Hellboy that it was podcast number 216. Well, the one with Dom Sullivan was 216. Hellboy was 217, so this is 218. And this week I'm joined by a non-Celtic guest. I am joined by Mr. Richard Gordon of BBC Sports Sound fame. The enthusiasm Richard's got for football is all too evident in the podcast coming up. And he was gracious enough to give me 2 hours of his time. And it was excellent company discussing all things about football, an hour and 10, 15 minutes of which are on this podcast. Richard's on talking about his time at Radio Scotland, Sports North Sound, and then going on to discuss the fact that he's got a book coming out, released on May the 12th. And if you go on the site, you'll see how to buy a copy of it. It's about the 1974 Scotland World Cup squad. Just at the earliest fringes of my recollection of football, are Sepp Maier with his giant hands in the German goals. For that bit specifically, Richard is talking about Scotland's time in the qualifying and then up to playing in the 74 World Cup, where famously, with a fantastic squad, Scotland only just missed out on qualification, on goal difference, unbeaten, and went home. So, without further ado, this is me, Harry Brady, and him, Richard Gordon. I'm joined now by a non-Celtic person. I'm joined by Richard Gordon. How are you doing, Richard?
Very well indeed. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me along.
No, that's okay. Well, you've got a slight problem for me, because normally we start a podcast with a new guest, asking him, what was the first Celtic game?
I remember my first Celtic game.
Well, you can tell it's your first Celtic game. And who was your first Celtic hero?
Well,
you can't jump that
to be fair, probably Kenny Dalglish, because I just thought he was marvellous. And I was there at Pittodrie the night he made his Scotland debut against Belgium. And so there was a big story about that at the time. So I've always remembered that. I mean, I thought he was a marvellous player. My first Celtic game would have been at Celtic Park. And there's a happy ending, because Aberdeen won 1-0, Joe Harper scoring the only goal, which would have been October, November 1970, I guess. Right. So, and that follows on from my first Aberdeen game, which was the Scottish Cup semi-final of 1970. 1-0 win against Kilmarnock at the old Muirton Park. And Derek Mackay, who older listeners might recall, had a very brief spell in the limelight. Cup tie Mackay scored the goal in the quarterfinal, scored the goal in the semi-final, then scored two against your beloved Celtic in the final, which Aberdeen won. And that was when football began for me. You know, right. Aberdeen beating Jock Steen's all-conquering team of 1970.
Well, that's huge.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And immediately, even the start of the next season, I would go along with my dad. And then very quickly, there were a group of us, being about 9, 10, 11 at the time. We'd go to it was back in the old days when reserve games were played at the big stadium. You were at the reserve game 1 week, you were at the big team the next week, and that's where it all began.
In fact, I remember my brother was a ball boy at Celtic Park, so occasionally used to go to reserve games at Celtic Park and watch it. And what was peculiar would be nothing happening on the park and people start cheering.
Yes.
Because their goals being scored at the away game.
Yeah.
So who was your first Aberdeen hero?
Probably Arthur Graham, who at the age of 17 had been discovered by the great scout Bobby Calder, who operated in this part of the world and who brought, I mean, all the greats of that era who came from the west of Scotland, Willie Miller, Alan McLeish, Arthur Graham certainly preceded them, but Arthur was 17, had been playing for Cambuslang, and had been spotted by Bobby. And within a couple of months, he was playing in the team that wins the Scottish Cup. And the great story at the time was that Arthur had offered Bobby Calder his Scottish Cup winner's medal. And of course, Bobby just, I never knew him, but everybody who talks about him said he was just the most remarkable man. I mean, the archetypal old scout, if you like, who would identify a kid who would turn up at the house with a bottle of whiskey for the dad and a box of chocolates for the mum and charm them all and suddenly
the kid this West of Scotland boy from Celtic or Rangers supporting West of Scotland boy from Glasgow up to
and Arthur was he was because he was a kid
canvas lang, he would have been a Rangers.
I never investigated that, I'll be honest, but he was just a great player. Bobby, I was a budding goalie. Bobby Clark was my hero. He was the first Aberdeen player, first football player that I met. My uncle knew him and took me along to his house, and he just treated me superbly and gave me a signed photograph. So he was a hero, and Joe Harper, just because Joe was the king at the time, the top goalscorer season after season.
Well, my first Celtic game was in '74, so you asked that. You're mentioning in Bobby Clark and Joe Harper, you're mentioning players that I can remember. Playing for Aberdeen, of course, I was only four back in my first Celtic game, so it was a bit vivid. So my strongest memories of Aberdeen start to come in just at the point where Aberdeen are at their peak under Fergie.
Yeah, I mean, I was incredibly fortunate, I suppose, to be in that generation. I followed them through the 70s, and by the mid to late 70s, there were a group of us going to all the away games from school. We used to, I'm sure, quite illegally hire buses. We were 14 and 15 years old, and groups of us would go off. So, I mean, it all just began to increase in terms of the other standards that the team were setting and the success they were achieving. 76 League Cup final, and then there's a little hiatus. Ali McLeod goes off to take over Scotland. Yeah. We have Billy McNeil for a season, and Billy is still so fondly remembered. And I know that he loved his year up there. Love staying in Stonehaven, and only Celtic were going to take him away, which they did. But of course, we landed up with Alec Ferguson, and through that period of time, I was then working, so I had a bit more money. I was able to go to all the games. I mean, I don't think I missed a home game during all that time, and I would have been at most of the away games.
Were you Easter Road?
Yes, in 1980. I drove down.
When not Celtic chucked away the league.
It's funny how now, because now you don't accept it. I mean, these days, I think it was about a 10-goal swing would have been required. Aberdeen would have had to lose 10-0 to Partick Thistle.
Right.
But these days, they don't seem to celebrate things on goal difference. They have to wait until it is arithmetically concluded. But that afternoon, I mean, the great, I mean, were packed in behind that goal at Easter Road. And Bobby Clark constantly turning around and asking the fans who had the transistors, radios as they were at the time, had them. What's the score? And of course, it filtered through. It was 0-0 at Love Street between St Mirren and Celtic. And it was a wonderful occasion because you knew by half-time we were winning that game.
Yeah.
So it was a party in the fact that we were, it was a beautiful sunny day and the stand, the terrace, it was packed with Aberdeen fans. And it was just waiting. And there are so many moments from that afternoon. But the one I always remember was Fergie running down the touchline and Bobby Clark and jumping into his arms and seeing this. And I know the players at the time, they were all delighted from themselves, obviously, but everybody was so excited for Bobby Clark. He's such a gentleman. Yeah. He's been such a servant to the club. He'd won the Scottish Cup in 70, he'd won the League Cup in 76, and here he was.
Wouldn't it have been that much difference in age between Bobby Clark and Ferguson?
No, absolutely not. I mean, Bobby's now in his early 70s, so they'd have been very, very close, yeah.
And did you ever think it was going to end?
I
should ask, when did you realise it was going to end?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't initially. The signs were there, excuse me, in the last season, the signs were there. I think that the signings that were brought in weren't quite replacing those who had left. You know, you looked at players and you thought, he's not quite at the level of the guy who was there before. So there was a sense that it was maybe just slightly, slowly starting to unravel. And then when the news came through that he was going to Manchester United, I remember my first reaction was, that's fine, Archie Knox will just take over and we'll be fine. But of course Archie wasn't given any choice. Yeah, I mean, he talks about that. He said he was taking the team for training up at Seaton, I think it was, and the car just, Fergie's car just rolled on down, the window came down, and the head was stuck out. It said, "We're going to Manchester United." And Archie said there was no contract talks, there was no discussions.
No.
He was just told he was going. So, Ian Porterfield was the chosen one.
That's right.
At the time. And I think there was a sense of, well, it was a name we knew as a guy who'd scored the winner for Sunderland in the FA Cup final of 73. Well-known name. Very quickly became clear that Ian spent a lot of his time in Eagles nightclub, as I recall, bumping into many times there. And, I mean, the discipline went, the training went, and very quickly it disintegrated. There was a slight revival when Alex Smith, Drew Jarvie, Jockey Scott, the kind of triumvirate, and won both cups in 89-90, came very close to winning the league. And then, I'm afraid, decline.
But I suppose part of the problem with that is it's only now with hindsight that we know that Scottish football changed the day that Graeme Souness arrived at Rangers, and then obviously with David Murray after that. And I think most football, I think fans of 41 clubs in Scotland understand that you can't spend, if your income's X, you have to spend X minus an amount.
Yeah, I think Aberdeen's problem is it took them too long to realise that, because there was...
Because at that time, managers were getting criticism for
not spending.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul Bernard, £1 million. You might not remember Sanko Svetinov and Ilyan Kiriakov, but they've gone down in the annals of history of Aberdeen Football Club, the two Bulgarian internationalists who cost a fortune.
Actually, it's one of these things where if you speak to people who are early 20s and tell them that Aberdeen used to spend £1 million on players, they wouldn't believe you.
Well, I mean, you're talking about Fergie spent, when Peter Weir was brought in, which would have been 81, swap deal, Ian Scanlon and £330,000 for Peter Weir. 34 years ago.
Yeah. There's no
just,
way.
It's mind-boggling.
Things are, I suppose, players' wages and things like that. So, in that rise and fall of Aberdeen Football Club, at what point did you start working in the media?
I had started at Hospital Radio in 87, and then I started at North Sounds shortly after that as just as a part-time reporter, just covering the Aberdeen games. Mm-hmm. Or Ken McRobb, who people will remember. Mm-hmm. Kenny was in charge then at the time. He gave me the opportunity to come on as a trainee journalist. I'd been working in the bank, and it was a kind of no-brainer. You don't get that kind of opportunity too often in life. So actually myself and Lorraine Davidson, who went on to become the great Labour spin doctor.
Yes.
Lorraine and I started the very first day at North Sound, and a week later Kenny left to join Clyde. And we had no one. I mean, it was 3 years that I spent there, and it was the best learning curve ever, because we did it ultimately, I think about a year later, we'd got a more experienced journalist.
In that environment, you sink or swim, don't you?
You do. And I mean, this is at a time when there was a lot of news happening up in the northeast. That Piper Alpha happened at the time. There were other big, there was a Peterhead prison siege. I mean, there were very, very big. And it was generally, it was news and sport that I was doing. And it was great because it taught me so much about the business. And both in terms of, from a journalistic point of view, but also just from getting experience sitting down behind a microphone and talking. So that was 3 years. I had just over a year in the newsroom at Radio Clyde. I came down, I gave up the sport for that. I just felt I needed to concentrate more on the news side of things and doing reporting. And then October 91, I was taken on by the BBC on a six-month maternity leave cover for Alison Walker, who was off having first.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Son at the time, and I've kind of hung around like a bad smell ever since.
So, when you're at North Sounds, you can still be pro.
Oh, very much.
Aberdeen.
Yeah.
Which, one of the things as a Celtic fan slightly irritates me, if we talk about Clyde for a moment, that Clyde, apart from when they're playing in Europe, Clyde feels it can't do, perhaps, what local radio stations do throughout the rest of the UK, which is be very pro their local teams.
Because you've got more than one team.
But I think they could still be pro Celtic and Rangers to the detriment of everybody else.
Uh-huh.
But for some reason, they try and not be.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest.
I mean, yes, their coverage is heavily weighted Celtic Rangers naturally.
Right.
But in terms of being talking up Celtic Rangers,
I don't think they do a great job.
I mean, I'll be honest, I hear very little. In fact, I don't know when I last heard their sports coverage, generally, because we're on when they're on, and I will listen to, I'll either be broadcasting or I'll be listening to what we're doing, because that's more relevant from my point of view, because if something's referenced in a programme that, say, Spence's presenting, then I need to know what's happened. So I'll be honest, I don't know. I mean, I would say from my experience that there have been some very good Celtic people who have worked at Radio Clyde over the years.
Which is a point I'm going to go into in a second about touching on you being pro-Aberdeen. You can be pro-Aberdeen in North Sound. I will be honest, I couldn't objectively report on a Celtic or Rangers game if I was a journalist.
Right.
And it must be a skill to do it. How could you possibly sit at Celtic Park when Celtic won 9-0? I couldn't do it.
Well, bizarrely, because as people will probably be aware, normally on a Saturday afternoon I'll be in the studio because we do the open all mics, and we've tried it at Grant, and it's next to impossible. Mm-hmm. The whole kind of technical mix, the balance, all the kind of voices coming in, it's a nightmare trying to do it at a Grant. So generally I'll be in the studio. That particular weekend was the weekend that the bloody referees decided to have their strike.
That's right.
So we couldn't do that. The games were limited, and therefore the decision was taken. Right, Celtic Aberdeen is the standout game. We'll just present from Celtic Park. So I trotted along quite happily to what. No, it was. It actually reached the point where I think I was just kind of laughing hysterically towards the end. You couldn't imagine it was going to get worse, and then it did. And then it did. I mean, fortunately, you know, Liam McLeod, who I'm sure people know, he's an Aberdeen fan as well. Liam had to do the commentary, at least during the game itself. I was just sitting there sinking lower down in my seat. And you know, there are a number of the guys, regular faces that you see in the main stand, who sit just off beside the press, and you're on nodding terms, and they were having great joy looking over at me and smiling as every goal.
But I do think, unlike, there are some members of the media who I don't think they do very well, but there are other people who, yes, you admit you're an Aberdeen fan, and in fact, I do wonder, do you have to be either an Aberdonian or a Chukta to get a job in Radio Scotland?
Yeah, it's actually it is written into the contract.
Yes. There's an honesty about yourself or Jim Spence, and I'm not saying that because you're sitting here, about you support that team, that's fine, you've got that natural bias that's going to be built into anything, but it doesn't come across gratingly like it does actually with those members of the media who try to pretend that they're Suburban fans or whatever.
Yeah, I wonder who you could be talking about.
Well, there's two or three actually who try to pretend they're Suburban fans.
Yeah.
One in particular.
It took a while. I mean, it wasn't obvious initially, and you know, I think it was dear old Bob Crampsey who first on air had said something about, quite innocently, because Bob was just the most incredibly lovely gentleman ever, but had referred to the fact that I was an Aberdeen fan, and it just kind of very gradually kind of got picked up. So it was probably over the first, might have been 5 or 6 years of doing the programme, that just slowly this, and it just got to the point where I suppose more and more people were aware of it, and it just became, and let's be honest, for a long time it was a standing joke. Let's give the Aberdeen fan a kicking because the team are rubbish. Yeah. And so maybe that made it easier, and maybe it's made it a little bit easier now that we're a little more successful than we have been. But look, hey, I'm an Aberdeen fan, but I've got a job to do. I've been critical of the team many times. After that 9-0, Mark McGee famously stood doing the interview and said, "It's only 3 points." And I must admit, my cloak of unbiased coverage fell away. And I think I said something, well, you know, it might only have been 3 points to Mark, but the team that I've supported for the past 40 years just died out there this afternoon. Yeah. And that was how I felt. And I said so. And actually, Mark phoned me the next night and we had a chat about it. And he explained what it was he was trying to say. And it's the problem, I suppose, that managers, players have at times, trying to hit the right balance under trying circumstances when the dust has by no means settled. And he got it wrong. And I said that to him. As far as I'm concerned, he got it wrong. I could understand maybe what he was trying to say, but he didn't. It was the wrong time to say it. It slipped from time to time.
I would find it difficult if I give the Celtic losing to Aberdeen in the Cup as an example. Maybe I could, because I wouldn't have the balls to just say it to his face. But if I'd had the opportunity straight after that game, I would have said to Neil Lennon, Neil, why did you pick the only formation which Celtic have lost with this season to play against Aberdeen?
Yeah.
When you've not been picking that formation for the last month and a half? Because that would be the fan in me coming out and asking that. That's not really a professional way to ask the question.
No, I mean, you have to... certainly asking the difficult question, if you like, it's never bothered me, but there's a way to ask it. And I think there are some people who seem to feel you need to be very aggressive and very confrontational when you're doing an interview. I mean, generally, my style of interviewing will be exactly the same. You know, you and I are just sitting and having a nice, pleasant chat. Well, there's no reason why I can't interview someone and ask difficult questions in exactly the same way. You have to. Like, you're not going to. If you've got somebody in front of you, whether it's after a game or work with an interview, and there are certain things that you want to cover during that interview, and there is one particular stink bomb of a question that you know you're going to have to ask, you're mad to ask it right at the start because you're going to lose the rest of the interview. You know, so you have to be strategic, I suppose, about it. But 99% of the time, the person you're interviewing will know that question's coming, and they'll be fully expecting it. Neil Lennon would have handled that in the way that Neil Lennon does, because he's an intelligent guy who knows what it's all about, and he'd have answered it straightforwardly, because he's always done that. I mean, in my experience, I don't interview him very often because of my job. You know, it's more the guys who are down pitch side who'll be doing that. But I'd have no qualms about asking him that. Similarly, I would expect him to answer it. Now, he may not answer it exactly the way that you want him to, but he'll answer it honestly from his point of view.
To be fair to mentioning fans there, to be fair to talking of Neil Lennon as well, to be fair to Chip Young, he does actually appear to like Neil Lennon.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no, he's... I think he's known Neil for a long time. He's known everybody for a long time, to be honest.
I suppose from a fan's perspective, there is a part of us that gets a wee bit irritated with the insulting your intelligence bit.
Uh-huh.
Graham Spears is a Rangers fan. I knew Graham Spears was a Rangers fan before he said he was a Rangers fan. There's an element of, you're from Aberdeen and into football. It'd be very odd if you weren't an Aberdeen fan.
Mm-hmm.
You're certainly going to be a fan of somebody in Scotland. And if you're not an Aberdeen fan, being in Aberdeen, that would mean that you'd be a Celtic Rangers fan, because that's the nature of Scotland. If you're not the fan of the local team, you'll support either Celtic or Rangers.
Yeah, almost certainly.
So there's a slight irritation, certainly amongst people that I know, as to why certain people in the media feel that they can't, whether it's an editorial decision, why they can't be honest about the team that they support. If you know somebody's prejudices, you can then say, right, okay, he's coming from that position, but you're still giving an honest opinion. Either don't say anything the likes of Tom English, but don't do the pretend to be another supporter thing. That's actually more annoying.
Yeah. I mean, certainly in all the time I've been at the BBC, and I can only really talk about them, that I have never seen or heard an editor say this to anyone, a contributor of any kind, you're not allowed to say who you support. So, I mean, but I think a lot of people will probably choose not to say they're a Rangers fan and not to say they're a Celtic fan, because they imagine that it will bring all sorts of inherent problems.
Yes.
You know, I mean, clearly, you know, I suppose it is easier to say I'm an Aberdeen fan than it is to say...
Well, my father-in-law always talks about when he arrived in the west of Scotland, the first thing he did was said he was into rugby. And that stopped it. But yeah, are you a Celtic rugby man or a Rangers rugby man was the next question.
I always remember years ago there was, it was online, I think, somebody had printed, and it was various people in the media, and it was... who they say they support and who they really support. And I was chuffed to bits that Aberdeen were both of mine. Whereas most of the rest, it was Dumbarton, Sitmarin, Partick Thistle, the regulars, and clearly in suggestions of links to either half of the old firm.
50% of... If there's 4 million people going to watch football in Scotland this year in total, 50% of them will go and watch just two teams.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, gone to the media. There's no Rangers and Celtic fans in it. That's...
Do you think that's... I mean, I sense that's changed. Although, I'll be honest, there are lots of people in the media that I have actually got no idea who they support.
Well, I remember Graham Spears when Andrew H. Smith got his job at the Scotland Sunday. And Graham Spears making a comment, now the numbers will be wrong, but it was something like, well done, Andrew H. Smith, that's 25-5. 25 ex-Rangers employees and 5 ex-Celtic employees now working in the media in Scotland.
Yeah.
And I also remember... on one occasion when it might have been an international weekend, so he probably thought nobody was listening, Hugh Keevan's talking about the press voting for Player of the Year and saying, well, of course, it's usually a Rangers player who wins it because the majority of people in the press are Rangers fans. But it was one of those comments that I think he thought he could get away with. He would never have said it if Celtic Rangers were playing that day.
Never having been a member of the Football Writers Association, you can't pin that one on me, have to say. I sense it's maybe changed. I think more people have certainly on radio have spoken about. I mean, Graham is an example. I don't recall Graham making that obvious 10 years ago, but certainly I recall him making it very obvious in the back. And he talks often, doesn't he, about going along to Ibrox with a scarf on and things. But I mean,
it's from his perspective, it's maybe illustrates a confidence in what he's doing. He feels he can now say it without having to hide, a bit like Billy Connolly, was a Partick Thistle fan at first.
I remember way back, and when I first went to the BBC Sports Inn, was a very different animal to what it is now, and it covered all sorts of minority sports. Mm-hmm. You came on, you went right. I mean, now I'll go in. I'll have one sheet of paper. It's got a list of the guys who are at the grounds, and that's all. That's all I've got. Whereas before, in the good old BBC way, there would be a 30-page script with all these links and all the different times when you did all these things. So you would go around the grounds. You would go to the hockey, the rugby, the whatever. I mean, the snooker. Whatever we were covering during the course of the afternoon, and nobody listened. You couldn't do football. You couldn't do the whole commentary. You went for the last 5 minutes of the first half.
That's right. Yeah.
And then there was great jubilation when we finally got that increased to the last 15 minutes of the first half. So it was, we had to kind of change it. I mean, we had to kind of put a bomb on the program and just enliven it because it needed it. And it took a while. And I think we finally got there and we changed the whole emphasis of it. I mean, initially there was myself, Jim Craig, that's Bob Cramsey. We didn't actually have pundits as such.
You more or less came across from Clyde, because Jim Craig and Bob Cramsey were at Clyde.
Yeah, I think, they were there when I came to the BBC. I think Dougie had been in charge at the time. He started to try to change it, and he had brought them in.
And then Jerry McNeigh.
Jerry had gone
the other way. That's
yeah,
right.
Jerry, I never worked with Jerry at all. But, I mean, from then, right the way through, there have been various accusations levelled at the BBC about not employing former Celtic players. And, and there has. I mean, it's an undeniable fact that there are more players who have played for Rangers than players who have played for Celtic who have been regulars on the programme. You know, that's not an editorial edict that has been put out. You say, who have you used? Well, actually, you go through them. You guys, we have used the last few years for Champions League and basically, Peter Grant, John Hartson, Willie McStay, Tom Boyd has done stuff with us. Pat Bonner has done stuff with us. Owen Coyle.
Yeah.
Owen, exactly. The problem is that all these guys have jobs,
mm-hmm.
or most of the time
yeah.
have had jobs. It was difficult. And I mean, it's something that's been addressed in the past. I mean, they've looked at it, well, who can we get? Murdo obviously has been with us for a long time. It's great to have Murdo there, and it would be lovely to have representatives of every team in Scottish football. But there's a small pool of people who are available and who actually have a talent to do it.
And part of your problem is you really should be trying to get a rotation of players who've not long retired who are closer to the game.
Yeah.
And that will be coming. Name the Scottish ex-Celtic players who've retired in the last 10 years who you could get on mm-hmm. board, because there's not been that many Scottish people who are kicking around who would then be bothered doing it.
No, I mean,
so I can see your challenges. I mean, so Simon Donnelly, Jackie McNamara, Dan Jackson, they're United.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's been easier because, and again, this is something that's changed in the past, about 5 or 6 years, having the nighttime magazine programme, 6:10-7, and then if there's live football, obviously we're on until 10 or 10:30, whenever it is. But when I went there initially, we had a Saturday. You didn't do Sundays, because there wasn't very rarely any Sunday football. And we had to fight like furies to get occasional midweek nights. I mean, it wasn't like it is now, whereas if there's football on, we'll pretty much be there. So there are more opportunities, more programmes. So in the last few years, there's been more of an opportunity for getting guys who are actually still playing the game or who as you say, have just retired, and get them involved, if not on a Saturday afternoon, then they'll do some of the midweek programmes. There is, though, it's a lot easier to get guys who are playing for Kilmarnock, Dundee United, Hibs, Motherwell, Aberdeen, get them on, than it is to get somebody who's playing for Celtic right now, or you know, Rangers when they're in the top.
Not to demean it, but if you're on $5,000 to $10,000 a week, you're not topping up your salary with it. Would you bother yourself when you could go and play golf?
There are guys who, some guys have surprised me over the years. You come in and you've thought, do you really want to be doing this? But actually, they get it right away and they seem to enjoy. Mm-hmm. You know what? They like football.
Yeah.
And I often think about that. I look at Cristiano Ronaldo and I think, do you like football? Do you sit at home and watch a game when it's on the telly?
Andy Cole didn't like
football. That's right.
Went to his house and there was no football stuff and he never watched it on telly.
But I think back to the guys of the 70s who I watched and who you watched and I bet they loved football.
Yes.
I bet they loved it. And if there was then it didn't happen very often, but if there was a game, live game on the telly, I bet they watched it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the mentality is still the same anymore, but we've certainly found enough of guys. I mean, Michael Stewart's one who's come through. I think Michael speaks very well.
Particularly because he was brave enough to do something that a player who's just left the game doesn't normally do, and that's give people who are currently in the game a kicking.
Yeah.
And that he was very critical of Ali McCoist describing Rangers as a team who look like they don't get coached. They play a style of football. And I was pleasantly surprised that he did that, not just because I'm a Celtic fan, he's giving a kicking. More because of his honesty when he's just left the game. Because that's the hardest thing for people to do, to come straight out of the game and then start criticising.
Yeah, I mean, you get occasional exceptions. The best exception ever was Jim Loughlin, who was the Kilmarnock captain at the time, but was out injured and did the co-com for us in a European tie and spent 90 minutes slaughtering his teammates and Bobby Williamson. It was brilliant. That was just fantastic.
Well, talking of European games, because again, one of the reasons why we go into that, I wasn't particularly saying it was a bias. It's more just an irritation that I wish people had the confidence to be honest about.
Uh-huh.
That again, something that maybe if I was caught up in the moment of it, that I think, again, not blowing smoke up your backside, but yourself or Lee McLeod do a fantastic job of sounding as though they are genuinely delighted when Celtic win a European.
But I'm coming at it from a slightly different angle, I suppose, than just a normal Aberdeen fan, because from a business point of view, it's great. I would much rather be dealing. I know that there is this assumption that the media want bad news all the time. I'd much rather be dealing with good news and positive stories and excitement and drama of a positive nature rather than a negative nature. I support every Scottish team in European competition. I don't want to see any of them lose. I did some Aberdeen away ties, European ties, when I was at North Sound. I think my first at the Beeb would have been Neuchâtel Xamax away, which I won't dwell on. But I remember sitting there and just feeling awful that night. Was it Hossam Hassan scored four, I think, for the
Roy Hodgson was.
And it was horrible. And then just after that, Rangers had the first Champions League season. They had that run through, and I was at all the games on the way and reporting on them. And it was, I know that people say that there's this Aberdeen Rangers thing. Well, I was able, as a professional, I suppose, to put that aside. I think, I'm just delighted to see a Scottish team doing well. The other side of it is you get to know people at clubs.
Yes.
You build up relationships. And if I like somebody, I'm happy if things are going well for them. So St Johnstone, right at the start of the season, St Johnstone, I mean, it was hardly a European run, but two away wins in European competition. To beat Rosenborg was incredible. And then it was, desperately disappointing to go out in the way that they did in the penalty shootout. But those two nights at McDermott Park, almost full. Now, I know it's not quite Celtic Park on a Champions League night, but it was a wonderful occasion. Mm-hmm. It was a great
and
experience
for those fans.
For all those fans. Yeah. So I will always support every team. And I mean, I have to say, in recent years, obviously, the European nights have been in the main. Have been the Champions League nights at Celtic Park. And the atmosphere on some of those nights. And it's the strange one. I mean, of course, Man United was fantastic. you know, playing Barcelona, just getting the chance to see some of these players. Uh-huh. But, you know, Alexis Karagandy at the start of the season, the last-minute goal that, that wins the tie. I mean, how can you not get excited as a football fan when you're in the midst of all that, and you're seeing Neil Lennon heading down the touchline and throwing yourself on top of the Celtic?
I, to tell you, I understand, when I was 17, 18, a friend of mine played for Clyde. And it was his 18, Celtic had won the double in the centenary season. And Clyde needed to beat Dunfermline to have a chance of staying up. And Dunfermline needed a point to get into the Premier League. And I was in amongst the Clyde fans. Wow. And I remember Clyde won. East End Park, and I remember going crazy because I knew one of the people on the pitch. I knew a couple of other people through him, and so I also then remember one of my friends who was with me, unbeknown to me, was making all sorts of gestures to Dunfermline fans because he's used to being in amongst the mass of the Celtic fans where you can do that. And I turned around and said, "What are you doing?" in a more expletive fashion, because we just walk out of that gate, and so did they. And we ended up having to hang about for half an hour afterwards because we were too bright to go outside. So, but I understand your point when you when you're caught up in it.
And it's good for the game. I mean, look, hey, I know it's better for Celtic than it is for any other team, but Celtic are so far ahead in terms of resources and finances right now, and it's only going to increase. But there is a spin-off for Scottish football, and if Scottish football is being viewed more positively on a Euro-wide basis, then, as far as I'm concerned, that's a good thing.
So talking about Scottish football, since we talked long enough about all the other stuff, you've got a book coming out on the 12th of May about Scotland in the 74 World Cup. So, first of all, do you want to talk about what the... Because it's your second book?
I did Gothenburg. It seems I'm going to be... If I do any more, it'll be anniversary. I'll have to look for a 50th anniversary, a 50-year anniversary. I did... So it was Gothenburg 30 years on. Spoke to all the guys who were involved in the squad, told the story, and it was a joy to do that. This was chance. The guy who the agent who first kind of got me into writing, we were throwing about ideas. He said, "Well, it's the 40th anniversary of 74," and initially wasn't sure. But the more I thought about it, I thought, "Well, there's been a lot written about 1978." And the more recent World Cups are all things are relative, they're perhaps fresh on the memory. But I just thought, you know what, that was actually my first World Cup, really. I kind of vaguely remember watching bits and pieces of 70. But this was a World Cup of which Scotland were at. I remember all the excitement. I remember the playing card, the cards you got. Mm-hmm. I remember some of the newspaper, the promotions they were doing. And there were all sorts of little things that I remember, you know, the single... and the album coming out, all sorts of little things. And I just thought, well, hold on, look at that squad. Look at the players, look at the characters who were involved. And look at the talent that we had then. So in the end, I didn't quite do it in the scale that I did with Gothenburg. Of the squads, five are no longer with us, because Sandy Jarvan most recently. Yeah. The manager had passed away again. So I realised a lot of this was going to have to be kind of archive research. So whereas Gothenburg was a lot of, I could draw in a lot of personal memories and get it out from the guys. This, I spent hours and hours and hours and hours going back through old newspapers. I found some fantastic little side stories that all kind of, things I had no idea. I mean, Zaire were going to be come over here to, after the draw had been made, Zaire were going to be come over here as part of their warm-up to play Dumbarton in a friendly. And then Hibs and Hearts decided they wanted them, and then there was an East of Scotland select was supposed to be, and none of it ever happened. But, I mean, there were lots of wee stories that were kind of on in the background. But it was wonderful going back and reading about all these. Many of these occasions I did remember, many of the games I remembered, others I found out things I didn't know. And in the end I spoke to seven or eight of the guys. So it's a kind of timeline. It goes from, I suppose, in the way it sets the scene in terms of our previous World Cup experiences, and then picks up from Tommy Docherty taking over from Bobby Brown, starting the campaign, Willie Ormond taking over, and then the build-up to the campaign.
Willie Ormond game. First game, was it his first game? 5-0
against England.
That was
Bobby Clark, sadly. Bobby Clark played
Bobby Clark never made the 74 World Cup.
Bobby Clark never played.
He made the 78 World Cup squad, but not the 74.
Of the team, the first qualifying game was away to Denmark, and we won 4-1. and seven of the team.
Ali Hunter?
Bobby played in that game. Ali played in the against Czechoslovakia. Let in the dodgy goal and never played for Scotland again, so he never made it.
Yeah.
But of the seven who kicked off against Denmark in the first qualifier, when the squad of 40 was announced 18 months later, seven of that team weren't in the 40. And it's guys like Bobby Clark, Pat Stanton, John Brownlee.
Pat Stanton?
Yeah, you know, he didn't make the 40. No, he'd had a fallout. He hadn't gone. There was a trip to Brazil, which he decided he didn't want to go on. But he was actually recalled the squad. Anyway, it's astonishing to look at. And even if you look at the 40, there are guys, there was a mixture of younger players.
Because one of the things, from my perspective, I remember the 70, start to really remember the 78.
Yeah.
I just have a vague recollection of 74 existing. Mm. But Jim Stewart.
Jim was in the squad. He's one of the guys I spoke to. And what I've tried to do is, I've spoken to guys who played in all three, guys who had played in one or two, and then spoke to Jim, who was brought along as a kid, as the third choice goalie. It's incredible to see the names. I mean, Souness was in the 40. He was a kid at the time, that was good.
Was he in Middlesbrough?
Yeah, he was. Jim Hermiston, was in the 40. I can never. Jackie Copeland was. There were three or four Dundee players in and around the squad. Uh-huh. In the end, Thompson Allen was the only other goalie. He went, Thompson and Jim Stewart. But I mean, the team at the time, and it was the core of the Leeds team that was so successful back then. So you had David Harvey in goal. Yeah. You had Sandy Jardine, Jim Holton, Martin Buchan, John Blackley were the three central. John played in the first game against Zaire, and then it was Martin and Jim Holton and the two others. Mm. And Danny McGrain played at left back.
Which people got wrong on Saturday. When
I heard that. Yes. I heard them talking about that. They were talking about Danny being right back. And then the Davy Hay. I've looked back at the footage. The three players who stood out for me over the three games were Sandy Jardine, Davy Hay, who was, Davy is, what a lovely guy Davy is, and I've known him for a long time, and I spoke to him for the book. He was the first interview I did for the book. I didn't remember what a good player Davy Hay was.
Davy is one of these people. He became Celtic manager at 36 or 37, so he's one of these people that I should have been remembering in his peak. He went to Chelsea, the eye injury, and never really was a big player.
At that time, he and Bremner, Lorimer,
you can
Willie
understand
Morgan.
Why Stanton can.
Aye?
Yeah.
Tommy Hutchison came on as sub and a couple of them. Joe Jordan, Kenny Dalglish, Dennis Law. Played in the one game against Zaire. So, just mentioning those names, I think tells you there's a book in there.
Yes.
So it was wonderful to do it.
That's a World Cup semi-final team.
Yeah. Well, you know this, there are quotes that Billy Bremner gave, that Willie Orman gave, that are right up there with anything Ali McLeod said 4 years later. But maybe slightly simpler times, maybe not quite put across in the way that Ali, the great showman, put them across. Ignored. Buried 20 paragraphs down, inside back page. Whereas, somebody says that now. Well, for a start, they're laughed at. Yeah. But
the 74 and 78 World Cup squads were squads and teams that should have been capable of getting up to quarter, semis.
Yeah, I think
different structures, because they're not 78, they played two group stages.
Yeah, they did. I think that's, well, they did in 74 as well. They kept the same format for the two. But that 74 team, I think they were victims of the fixture list, if you like. They played Zaire first, they had no idea what to expect. Yeah. They got a bit of a scare. They got to 2-0, but that's it. Yugoslavia then went out and beat them 9-0. A few days later. Now, there's a whole, again, it's covered, but John Blackley is convinced to this day that there was a conspiracy there. He said, because they were never a 9-0 team, as John. And so I've done a bit of digging into that.
Is there no evidence that Tito
It was more to do with the fact that that there were various riches that were offered to these players from the Zaire government at the time. These riches then went disappeared along with a couple of government officials, and they had a visitation from the security forces in the dressing room ahead of the Brazil game, saying, if you lose this by more than three goals, you're coming home, but you ain't got much of a future, essentially. I mean, it's astonishing, some of it. So they haven't taken it, of course. They lost 3-0 to Brazil, the dodgy cross comes short from the corner. But that was a game in which, I can't remember the chap's name now, but the fullback who ran out and kicked the ball away. And there, I found some quotes from him, and he was saying, everybody said that it was just the Africans at the time, they didn't understand the game. They were, you know, they were very naive. He said, no, I knew exactly what I was doing. I wanted to get sent off. I wanted off that park. You know, all my money had been taken away by the generals who were sitting up in the stand. Why should I be out there? Mm-hmm. And he said, so he ran out, kicked the ball away, hoping he'd get sent off. And he was only booked at the time. But no, I mean, it was a hell of a World Cup. Mm-hmm. And of course, the great Dutch team. I touch on the rest of it, but the rest of it is really a side issue. In the main, it's a Scotland squad.
So when you're going to write a book, as you just said, you look at the team and you say, there's a story to be had about the World Cup. Yeah. You've obviously got Tommy Docherty and the type of person he was. He could have been an Alan McLeod, possibly. Yeah, yeah. And then him going and Willie Ormond coming in and the players that we got. There's a book there. How do you sit down and say, right, okay, I'm going to have to create a narrative out of this? So how do you do that?
Yeah, with this one, I just did it on a timeline. I just thought that there are so many different ways to approach this. I think the easiest thing is just to, right, this is the history. Let's just do it on a chronological basis. And what I did was, with the Gothenburg book, there were distinct chapters for each of the players, and each of those chapters then covered one of the games in the European run, and so it all kind of, it was easier to bring together. This one took a lot more pulling together because it had all sorts of quotes about all sorts of different aspects from all sorts of different players. But there were obvious little kind of stopping points. You know, the games were the obvious points, and then you're filling it in with the kind of archive reports out with that. And I mean, obviously there's the... One of the favourite moments, it was the whole kind of the Larks fishing boat thing, obviously. Yeah. And I mean, it's astonishing how many different retellings there are of that story in completely different circumstances. Everybody has a completely different memory. Uh-huh. So I've kind of drawn together the various recollections of the various players, along with some of the archive reports. And obviously, it ends up Jimmy does get rescued and is chosen. The press are saying, he can't play against England on the Saturday. So Willie Ormond plays him, and he is the standout man of the match.
Yeah.
People might remember the images of him and Peter Shilton's soaking wet goalie's jersey down past his knees, you know, kind of celebrating around the pitch. I found some footage, and there's a brilliant moment where Willie Ormond, so Jimmy's in the centre circle, and Willie Ormond's running towards him, and just runs into shot and goes up to him, and whispers something into Jimmy Johnson's ear, and Jimmy just turns around up the press box and starts flicking the V's up at the press box. And the manager has clearly told him to get into them because they've been having a go at you for the past few days. And it's just wonderful. So lots of little things like that. And really, really lovable characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, wonderful football players. And I don't know how many of them would cope with the kind of the much more regimented approach there is to the game these days, but boy, did they have.
Well, that's one of the things. You look back in a modern world perspective and you think, oh, you mentioned the players, and I said that's a semi-final World Cup team. You do look back and you think, just imagine if they had a manager in the way that managers are much more tactical today. But then, so would every other team, and so would, you know.
There was certainly a freedom of it. I tell you what will strike, would strike if you look back.
Do we look back with fondness because they played in a certain way because they didn't have that?
The game was so slow. I mean, the amount of footballers afterwards, the game is so much quicker. But you look back, the Scotland-Brazil game in that World Cup final, so I watched the whole 90 minutes, cannot believe how pedestrian it is. Now, it was a very warm day, that may have contributed, but it was really, really slow. Players had far much more time on the ball. And then, of course, the whole different aspect of it is, it's refereed entirely differently.
Yeah.
I mean, that game re-refereed. It wouldn't be quite the 1970 FA Cup final Chelsea-Leeds, but if it was that Scotland-Brazil game was re-refereed today, I would think there would be 3-4 red cards and anything, 15 yellow cards. And there were two. Rivellino got booked. He then sides down Sandy Jardine. I mean, full, both legs, studs, everything. The referee, we got a free kick, I think that was it. And then a few minutes later, slaps or punches Billy Brennan in the face right in front of the referee. And nothing is happened. Nothing's done. So, I mean, it's, you know, for a few years, Barcelona were an absolute joy to watch. Yeah. And I kind of think they almost became a parody of themselves in terms of this we just keep passing.
Well, that's why
Arsenal.
That's why we beat.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but I can still take joy out of that. You look at that Copa del Rey final, and you know that goal of Bale's. I mean, that's just all pace, directness, sheer athleticism. But there's a real joy to that as well. So, I mean, I think there's so many different aspects of the game. I will try never to be the kind of old buffer going, it was way better in my day. I think there are always going to be things that you can take from it.
One World Cup back from your 74 boot, the 70 World Cup final, that everybody goes on about the Brazil goal. Yeah. And any time I watch that, I think that goal wouldn't be scored in modern football. Because the Italians would have closed it down.
Yeah.
There's no way you would just be standing off a guy watching him pass sides.
And yet the Italians at the time would have been seen, that was off the back of the whole Catenaccio thing, wasn't it? And they would have been seen as the lock-tight, watertight defence. I do have vague recollections of that. I was just enthused by Brazil and Peru, where they kind of came to the fore in that finals as well before they then did to us in 78. I think that's a great thing about football. No matter what age you are, you look back and you'll always pick out the highlights, the great memories. Yeah. There's so many. You get your kicking the goodies from time to time.
But one of my, on from the 70 World Cup, 74 World Cup final, one of my favourite things is a mixture of a slow and a pacey move is the penalty to Holland, because they're just passing the ball about. And the Germans are moving further and further up, and then they just go with pace. And that's what creates a penalty for them. So,
that was Cruyff, wasn't it?
But that's an example of slow and pacing.
And I suppose he will read Graham Hunter's book, and it was Cruyff who kind of set in motion the whole ethos at Barcelona and the way that they play. And they do. I mean, they do. Clearly, they have the opportunity or the ability to then burst through you and destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, I find myself, and Arsenal, there was a period when Arsenal, I thought, were the same, watching Arsenal, was exactly the same. It's just tippy-tap, tippy-tap. And you just, come on, shoot!
just have a go. Somebody put the ball in the, it's Celtic's problem when teams come to Celtic Park, when we play the formation that lost Aberdeen, is we just pass the ball about and don't actually play with any pace to get in behind. And then, then you look at British football as a whole and English football. As an aside for a moment, I was reading something with Xabi Alonso. Alonso was talking about reading about young Liverpool players talking about in a Liverpool programme once their skill set. And their skill set would be passing and tackling. And he couldn't believe that tackling was considered a skill. Because when he was growing up, if you had to tackle somebody, the team had failed to close down the space that people were moving into. And our perception of what... And then the other thing is this getting the ball down the wing and crossing the ball is old hat.
Yeah, they can call it old hat, but there are a few things more thrilling than seeing somebody at pace skinning a fullback and sending an inch-perfect cross into the...
The most exciting goal, one of the most exciting goals ever is Scotland qualifying for the 78 World Cup against Wales. In Anfield.
Martin Buchan with a cross.
With a cross.
Kenny Dalglish with a
header. Yeah, it's just the pace and movement of that. Yeah. So.
No, I mean, there are all sorts of ways of kind of putting the game down, I suppose, and being negative about it. I'm not blind to the fact that in terms of Scottish football, that we have our problems, and a lot of the problems are off the park and they're financial. But in terms of the product, I think the product, right now, this past season, has been as good as anything I've seen in decades, almost, across the board.
Yeah.
I mean, from your point of view, Celtic, clearly you've had your disappointments in the Cups, but the league form this season, and I've seen Celtic on occasion, Cali Thistle most recently, just absolutely clinical, creating, scoring excellent goals.
Fourth goal. When the fourth goal went in, it was one of those occasions, I actually said, one of my colleagues is a Dunfermline fan, and I started saying this to him on Monday morning, and then realised he won't have experienced this. I said it was one of those occasions where once the fourth goal went in, you're thinking to yourself, we can score as many as we can be bothered scoring. And then I realised I've never been there. I've been the other way round when you scored 8 at East End Park and you look like it. But we against Inverness, when the fourth goal went in, I thought, if we want to score 10 goals, we could score 10 goals today. If we want
You only do that against Aberdeen, don't you? There was a lovely tweet from the Cali Thistle, the official Twitter feed. It said, It was obviously, but it got the point where it was only now giving updates, and it was Celtic 6, Cali Thistle 0. Next goal the winner?
Yes.
And I love that because it kind of summed up for most of us, I think, our approach to Scottish football. Yeah. Like we all take it a wee bit too seriously at times. But actually, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had.
But you're right, I have enjoyed Scottish football. And I'm, you know, don't need you to comment on Rangers. I've enjoyed Scottish football without Rangers because the rest of Scottish football appears to be enjoying itself. From my perspective, obviously, yeah, we'd like a challenge and that makes it more competitive. But actually, there seems to be generally a greater sense of fun and enjoyment coming through from Scottish football.
I mean, I've got no problem saying that I've enjoyed the top flight. I've enjoyed it more in the last two seasons. Without Rangers, and that's nothing against Rangers. It's simply meant because for most of us, let's be honest, for most of us who support teams out with the Old Firm, or you know, throughout that period of time, from Aberdeen winning it in the mid-80s until now, it's only been Celtic or Rangers. So it's a matter of some indifference to most of us whether it was Celtic or Rangers who are winning the league. So what we've got now is a one-horse race rather than a two-horse race. Mm-hmm. And actually, the fact that it is just that one has opened things up. Because the rest of the teams are on a far more level playing field. They're able to beat each other.
Yeah.
You're able to break... You know, you've seen teams putting together 8-9 match unbeaten runs this season because they're not playing Celtic and then they're playing Rangers 4 weeks later and you're stalling the whole time. You're getting the chance to build up a confidence, to get a run going. I think there's been more freedom in terms of... You look at the teams in the bottom six right now in the playoffs. So most of them throughout the season have still... on occasions, more than occasions, played with a freedom, actually tried to play expressive football that's been good to watch. Now, that may change over the next couple of weeks because it's really got to the serious business. But I think generally, the standard's good. I'm really excited by the number of young players who are coming through at various clubs. And I think there was a lot of talk about, and I can understand why Celtic fans here, like, you know, clearly, for me, Chris Collins was the outstanding player of the year. But I think beyond that, there was a lot more competition for players who could quite rightly have said, look, we should be nominated or we should be in the team of the year. The PFA Scotland Team of the Year, I mean, I'd picked one for, we've all done it for various things, I suppose, and there were a couple of players different in mine than the players had chosen. But I then chose, I wrote down another 11 that didn't include any of the players I'd chosen or the players that they'd chosen. And you would look at that 11, and I would defy you to say that any of them didn't deserve to be in it. So I think that's an indication that that there's a lot. But the gap at the top will remain. And nothing. I mean, you know, the week of Aberdeen winning the League Cup, I was getting Don's fans, oh, if only Stuart E. Mellon put a few more quid in. It's like, it's not a few more quids that you need.
It's my point about it. Celtic needs £30 million to compete, and to go to the next stage in European football, and that's not a viable option. Celtic's turnover is £80 million, Aberdeen is not. Can you remember what it is? No. Maybe a tenth of that.
Yeah.
What you can do is stay in touch with us till Christmas, February time. You've got a better chance of doing that. And win a trophy.
Yeah, well, out with winning the League Cup, there's no question that the two highlights for me this season as an Aberdeen fan have been winning at Celtic Park in the Scottish Cup and ending Celtic's run. No, it's not nothing against Celtic. I'm an Aberdeen fan. I want Aberdeen to win that game. You know, Johnny, the excitement of Johnny Hayes and Willie Miller was doing the opening mics for that night, and the excitement of all that. And there's a bit of kudos there. We are the only, as it stands, we're the only team to have beaten Celtic in the league this season. That, you know, you're going to pick up your high points in a different way, I guess. If Aberdeen continue to challenge, and we should be up there second or third in terms of the squad that we have right now. You know, if I'm looking next season, if Aberdeen are up in a similar position, and if they either come close to or win cup competition, that's a good season.
And as a Celtic fan who I'd like competition, and I'd like competition because teams improve closer to us rather than us falling back. Also, at some point, a team called Rangers will play in the top flight of Scottish football again. The more, from my perspective, that actually the limited resources that come out of Scottish football after us that are channeled into just one team, it's actually the better, because you finishing second and winning the League Cup, and next season finishing second and winning a trophy or getting to two finals, that's £2 or £3 million more to the bottom line of Aberdeen than the past 20 years that Aberdeen have been getting. Yeah. So Aberdeen, whenever a team called Rangers play in the top flight again, Aberdeen will be able to compete with them for a season or two.
Yeah. I don't think, the report that came out recently and the suggestion, every club should have their ambitions. I think there has to be realism attached to it. And the thoughts that Rangers would be winning the top flight in Scottish football in three seasons' time seems ludicrous.
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned.
That was patently putting a cherry on the top of a...
But I think the vast majority of Rangers fans would have looked at that one. Because they've been watching that team all season long. These 40-odd thousand who go along every week. They know that team is a million miles away from doing it. And depending on what happens in a financial sense over the next few months, I guess, from Rangers, and depending on what kind of resources they have next year, obviously it depends what happens to Hearts and the assumption that they can see this through and that Anne Budge can get everything in place. The Championship will not be a stroll for Rangers next season.
And what could also help Aberdeen in that? If you guys could get into Europa League group stages next season.
Yeah, we've got three or four qualifying rounds to go through, unfortunately. But
if you could.
Yeah, of course.
And getting back to your point about how well Scottish football's doing, the rest of Europe likes the Europa League, but England doesn't.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest thing that holds Scotland back is we speak out the same language and we're right next door to England.
Yeah.
And we judge everything we do on England.
Yeah.
And the English don't like the Europa League. So we fall into the trap of, the Europa League, it's a waste of time. The rest of Europe likes the Europa League.
Yeah, I'm sure, I'm just going to say, I've had the experience of it. You would always want to be in the Champions League rather than the Europa League.
But having said that, I would quite like us to finish third in a Champions League group and drop into Europa League. Because I think if we get it right, we could then get two or three wins in the Europa League and have a decent
run. I mean, out with that, there's no... I mean, I talked about St Johnstone earlier, and... You know, we were kind of, they still had another round to go, but you kind of hope, right, they've won away from home, they hopefully could see that through. And that was a fantastic prospect, the thought of St Johnstone playing in the Europa League.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Aberdeen would certainly, when we got through to the group stage of what was then the kind of strange setup they had in the UEFA Cup, where you had the two home games, two away. But the excitement that night, and when we beat Copenhagen 4-0, it was the only game we won during the thing, but it was enough to, because there's a draw as well, it was enough to get us through to play Bayern Munich in the knockout stage. But that was magnificent. And, you know, Jimmy Calderwood just couldn't, he stabilised the club. He was in the top half of the league for 5 years, couldn't do anything in the cups. But the one thing Jimmy had in terms of cup competitions was beating Dnipro to get through to reach this group stage. That night against Copenhagen was just Jamie Smith scored a magnificent goal that night. And then, drawing it home to Bayern Munich. And just everything. And it allowed the present generation to feel just a little of what I felt for all those years.
Right, have given me plenty of your time, so thanks very much.
Not at all.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast, and as I said earlier at the beginning, the enthusiasm that Richard's got for football is all too evident in our conversation. Don't forget the Celtic Badge Day is coming up on May the 11th, and if you want to buy a badge, contributions are £1, minimum £1, on the match day, whether we're bucket collectors, and if you want to do something and just to put out your hand in your pocket, but actually help participate, they are looking for volunteers to help sell those badges and rattle those buckets. The email address, as was said in the last podcast, is CFCF. So that's Celtic Foxtrot Volunteer at CelticFC.co.uk. That's CFCF Volunteer at CelticFC.co.uk. St Anthony's got another good guest lined up. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Suffice to say, this is me, Harry Brady, saying good night. Good night.
Ripley looking at his watch. And that's it! Congratulations, Scotland. Well done, boys. Joe Jordan, the winner. Willie Ormond out on the edge of the track. Fans breaking onto the pitch at the far end. The substitutes are on. Look at Billy Bender's face. What a team effort this has been. Fans are on the pitch. Police are chasing them off. Absolute bedlam. And the crowd want a lap of honour for Scotland. They won't let them leave this field.